opportunity since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, as well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Our guest in our first half hour is California Energy Commissioner David Hochschild. Hochschild was appointed by California Governor Jerry Brown in February 2013. He fills the environmental position on the five-member commission, where four of the five members, by law, are required to have professional training in specific areas: engineering or physical science, environmental protection, economics, and law. Commissioner Hochschild's career has spanned public service, environmental advocacy, and the private sector. He first got involved in the solar energy field in 2001 in San Francisco as a special assistant to Mayor Willie Brown, where he launched a citywide $100 million initiative to put solar panels on public buildings. He went on to co-found the Vote Solar Initiative, a 60,000-member advocacy organization promoting solar policies at the local, state, and federal level. He served as executive director of a national consortium of leading solar manufacturers and worked for 5 years at Solaria, a solar company in Silicon Valley. In 2007, he served as a commissioner at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. For his work to advance clean energy, David Hochschild was awarded the Sierra Club's Trailblazer Award, the American Lung Association's Clean Air Hero Award, and the Department of Energy's Million Solar Roof True Champion Award. David Hochschild, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So tell us, what can America learn from what California is doing in the field of energy?
Well, it's actually a very, very exciting time for renewable energy in California. Our governor, Jerry Brown, the first major piece of legislation that he signed when he came into office in 2010 was a 33% renewable portfolio standard, which requires California to get one-third of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. And today, we're at about 23% renewables. And if you look around the state, it is extraordinary what's happening. The largest wind project in the world is in California. It's a gigawatt and a half, the Alta Wind Energy Center. We have the largest solar thermal tower and solar thermal trough projects in the world, the largest geothermal project in the world, the largest crystalline solar PV panel project in the world, and the largest manufacturer in the state of California today is Tesla, an electric car company, which now employs 6,000 people. And just last month, we passed a milestone of 100,000 electric cars and plug-in electric cars in the state of California. So the state is really moving forward quickly. And one of the benefits of that is it's attracted a lot of investment. And we've seen a whole bunch of innovation happen because the goal has been set. And we're seeing innovation really at every level, both in technology. You know, the cost of solar panels, for example, have fallen by 98% since 1980, but also in financing and new ways of financing electric vehicles and rooftop solar, doing it through leases and power purchase agreements. And California is kind of at the center of this. And I'm excited because what I see happening is really the technologies of the future, the clean energy technologies of the future, being incubated at the state level. And because we have 40 million people and big markets for these technologies, you can really get these technologies to scale. And so it's a very exciting time for that reason.
So you mentioned Tesla is the largest employer, the largest manufacturer in the state of California. So the idea of the Motor City being in Detroit, it sounds like it's more like Palo Alto or thereabouts.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. If you go back a few years ago, there was a factory. The only auto manufacturer in California was a joint venture of GM and Toyota. That was in Fremont, California, and they shut down in 2010. Big factory, the biggest auto manufacturer west of the Mississippi. And a lot of folks said, you know, that's the end of auto manufacturing in California. There's no way to do it economically. It's over. And then Elon Musk he came in and he bought the site for something like $58 million. It's now, today, it's valued at over $1 billion. And he turned it into this massive electric car factory where what appeared to be a disadvantage of not having done electric vehicle manufacturing or car manufacturing in any form before ended up being an advantage because he was able to design really what, in my view, is the most modern car factory in the world. The automation is absolutely astounding, and from start to finish, the process is really done to make high throughput and very, very efficient cars. And so they're on a path right now. The whole goal of Tesla is to build a $35,000 electric vehicle that goes 200 miles on a charge by 2016. That's the whole goal of the company. And it's a goal I think they're on a good path to achieve. So we, our agency gave them a $10 million grant to help them scale up. And we've seen some fascinating things. For example, I visited the factory twice this year, and there was a manufacturing process that had been outsourced, that had been basically in Asia, that they were able to bring back to California because the automation has gotten so good that it's cost effective to do that. So this is the kind of thing that's happening now. And this summer, the legislature just passed and the governor signed into law a goal for electric vehicles to get 1 million electric vehicles in California by 2020. And as I mentioned, we're just past the 100,000 milestone. And so I'm very optimistic about the future of electric vehicles because the costs are coming down. And of course, as you may have heard, one of the things that Tesla is now doing is building what's called a gigafactory, which is the largest battery factory ever in the world. It's actually going to be sited in Nevada, and they're manufacturing lithium-ion batteries. And the size of this factory is actually bigger than the entire global lithium-ion battery market. That's how big they're thinking. But that's how you get costs down. And if you look at how costs have come down in wind and solar and other technologies, and for that matter, cell phones or anything else that's gone to scale, really, getting to scale is a critical piece. Costs come down, really in one of three ways. You have innovation, automation, and scale. And all three of those are happening, but arguably the most significant is scale. And certainly with batteries, that's what's going on now. And so, I think, by the way, that's going to be good, not just for electric vehicles, but also for ultimately for home energy storage. People can get a battery pack, for their home as well.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation with David Hochschild, a member of the California Energy Commission. David was recently the keynote speaker at the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference that was recently held in Burlington. So if I'm building a house in California today, what are some of the requirements and efficiency requirements that I would have to meet?
So we set the strictest energy efficiency requirements in the country for new construction. The California Energy Commission sets those every 3 years. We just put into place the latest set of standards in July 1st of this year, and they're actually 25% stricter than the previous standards. So some of the things that you'll see if you're building a new house today to code, thicker insulation in the walls. So we're going to, 2x6 walls rather than 2x4, so you have more space for insulation. More insulation in the roof. We're requiring for the first time ever solar-ready roofs, which means that you have to have 250 square feet of unobstructed roof space, and you have to have a place for the inverter. It doesn't require you to have solar yet, but it requires you to be solar ready. And then just various other sort of duct sealing and all the things that make a house more efficient. And one of the benefits, it turns out, it's not just good for the environment, but it also ends up making it more likely that people will not default on their mortgages. There was a study done recently by the Institute for Market Transformation, which found that you're 32% less likely to default on your mortgage if you live in an energy-efficient home. And there's more money from lower utility bills. So it makes perfect sense. So we're going to keep pushing. The goal in California is by 2020 to have zero energy homes. be the standard. In other words, your house would basically produce as much energy from solar or other on-site renewables as it would require over the course of the year. And then to do that same zero net energy standard for all public buildings by 2025 and all commercial buildings by 2030.
How do you get such ambitious energy efficiency rules put into place? We're talking about every new home. I imagine there would be pushback from the home builders and others. So what goes into making this kind of political sausage?
Well, it's a great question. You know, interestingly, the home builders, I think, have been great partners in this. We've been working very closely with builders like KB Homes and Lennar. And, you know, right now we provide cash incentives for new construction that wants to do solar as an option. They actually get a rebate. We have a $400 million program to do that. And, you know, I think builders see the future. One, I've just heard anecdotally that communities, for example, when they build out a new community with solar, and actually the homes sell faster than those without. And, you know, I think that's becoming something people really, really want. I think there's, you know, also if you look at our history as a state, I mean, we have been through an energy crisis, and it's an interesting story going back 40 years ago. The Energy Commission itself was born out of an energy crisis. We had a problem where electric load 40 years ago was growing at 8% a year. And the state legislature commissioned the RAND Corporation to do a study. What's the, how do you meet this, you know, enormous growing electric load? And their answer was, you got to build 40 nuclear plants. Well, we have a 800-mile coastline in California. That's a nuclear plant every 20 miles, and that was totally unacceptable to the policymakers. And the Energy Commission was born to push in a different direction towards efficiency with very strict efficiency standards for appliances and buildings and towards renewable energy. And today we have one nuclear plant, not 40, operating in California, and we're using half the energy per capita of the rest of the country. So there is a history, I think, of some pretty bold thinking on efficiency and renewables, and the zero energy home piece is just one part of that.
So how did you get into the world of energy efficiency, solar, and the kind of work that you do today, David Hochschild?
Well, you are actually part of this story because you and I met, I think, in December of 1996 in South Africa. You were writing a book about the new South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa, and I was there working for President Mandela's youth program in the Eastern Cape, and in the townships there. And one of the first things that the new ANC government did after they took over from the apartheid government was they put mail service in the townships. And these were solar-powered postal stations, basically, that had lighting. And in the township where I was living, this became kind of a little gathering spot at night. There were lights, and people for the first time could exchange letters, you know, with other communities around the country. It was a, you know, an important sort of gesture, I think, to the townships. And I was quite fascinated. This is something that solar could do in an area where you don't have electricity. You could, you know, have this technology that would provide clean, quiet power and could be distributed. And in my mind, I got excited about that because it seemed to solve many problems at once. You know, obviously climate change is the biggest challenge of our generation, but, you know, air pollution and just the ability to bring power to remote corners of the world, all those needs. And I looked into it more, and I learned that every time demand for solar power doubles, the price goes down by 20%. And so after graduate school and after South Africa, I went back to work for the mayor in San Francisco. And I just got excited about that vision of creating policies that are going to grow the market so that the costs can come down and we can wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. And so we put together a $100 million bond initiative to put solar panels on public buildings. And we ran a very big campaign for that in November of 2001. And it passed by a vote of 73% from the people of San Francisco. And we now have solar panels on our convention center, on our airport, on reservoirs, and City Hall, and so forth. And
now that it's the week of the World Series, isn't there something you want to tell us about solar panels in the ballpark?
Well, I like to think that one of the reasons the Giants won, they were helped by a little solar power in that stadium. That was another project we did in partnership with the utility there.
Well, say more. The ballpark, AT&T Park in San Francisco, does it actually power itself partly or largely through solar?
It does, yes. So this is about 130 kilowatt system that's when you see a home run go over that right field wall and splash in the bay, right on that wall, there's solar awnings, these solar panels there.
This is assuming the Royals don't completely shut down the San Francisco offense.
Yes, fingers crossed. I went on. I wanted to keep going in the solar field. I got excited about the possibility of taking, seeing a technology like solar go from essentially being the smallest form of electricity generation in the world to the largest in our lifetime. And I absolutely believe that's the path we're on. I mean, for example, it was a big deal in 2004 when I went on to co-found a group called Vote Solar that does barrier busting and advances pro-solar policies at the state level. And in 2004, for the first time, the global solar market passed 1 gigawatt. It was a big deal. Well, the market this year was 52 gigawatts, and it's growing, at 30 to 40% a year. And, it's just a very, very exciting time. So I went on, did solar policy advocacy, worked in a number of different states, in New York and Hawaii and in California. We worked together, a whole bunch of organizations, to support a $3 billion solar program called the California Solar Initiative, with the goal of getting a million rooftop solar energy systems. And this was actually, in many ways, a model. I think Governor Schwarzenegger at the time was an absolute champion for that. And it was a great model because he was a Republican, the legislature was Democratic, and they came together and passed this. And so today, we have this goal of a million solar roofs. We're at about 300,000 today and growing very quickly. And the incentives for that, by the way, it started off, maybe a third of the cost when you get solar on your roof was paid for by a state incentive. Well, those incentives are almost gone today, and the market is still very strong. So half of the systems that got installed in California this year had no incentive at all, but the cost has come down through having this long-term program that the cash incentives weren't needed. And that's exactly the model. That's how you get to scale and bring down costs.
So in speaking of getting to scale, we're talking, by the way, here on the Vermont Conversation with California Energy Commissioner David Hochschild. Scaling up further to a national level, what does federal policy look like, and how has it changed, and maybe what have they borrowed from the California playbook?
Well, as I think happens, with many issues, there's a more dynamic leadership at the state level in many cases. I give the Obama administration enormous credit for what they've been able to get done. In the military, for example, they're moving very quickly on renewables. The Navy has a goal to get to 50% renewables by 2020. They're doing some very large-scale, wind and solar projects and energy efficiency upgrades. The Marines as well.
Let me just clarify. So when we say the Navy getting to 50% renewables, what are we talking about there? They have everything from bases to warships.
Right. So for their electricity consumption on their facilities, the goal is to be half renewables. So they are installing some of the largest wind and solar projects in the country today, and they're doing very significant upgrades on energy efficiency as well. And the same is true for the Marines. There's also been, a number of very key loan guarantees made by the federal government that have enabled some of the large-scale projects I was talking about earlier to happen. But one of the problems that we have is how energy is subsidized in the United States. There is a myth out there that needs to be busted, which is that there's somehow some technologies, oil and gas or coal, don't receive subsidies and renewables do. And it is an absolute myth. There is no such thing as an unsubsidized kilowatt hour in America, every form of energy receives subsidies. And in fact, we've been subsidizing coal for over a century. Even the construction of the rail network, for example, with federal funds to coal mining areas to get coal out more cheaply, that's a subsidy. You look at nuclear, which we've been subsidizing for 60 years, the Price-Anderson Act, which removes all the risk if there's a nuclear meltdown. The nuclear companies don't pay for that. That falls on the ratepayers. Well, there wouldn't be a nuclear industry today without that. And so I think the question often gets asked, well, what's the subsidy today, you know, this year for wind and solar versus fossil fuels? And it's the wrong question. The right question is, what is the all-in subsidy since subsidies began? And there was a wonderful study by a group called DBL that looked at this question, and they found basically the average annual subsidy for oil and gas has been $4.5 billion annually. For nuclear, it's about $2.5 billion. For all renewables, it's only $300 million. So the playing field has not been level. And it's actually remarkable to me that wind and solar have been able to come down in cost as much as they have, given that unlevel playing field. But that's one of the things we have got to fix, because the whole point of energy subsidies is you get them to scale. Does the oil industry really need, you know, an oil depletion allowance today? You know, these are questions that the federal government has to look at, because mature energy industries, you know, don't really need that, in my view.
What's your vision on a, you know, realistic short-term vision for, say, in the next 25 years in the United States? Where could we be with renewables?
So I'm very optimistic long-term. I believe that renewable energy is going to be the source of the majority of our energy, and fossil fuels will ultimately become the alternative energy. I just think if you look at the trends, the price trend is downward for renewables. And in addition, the public support for renewables is very strong. You know, we have a governor in California who's very popular, and he has made renewable energy a centerpiece of his plank. And, you know, he enjoys very strong public support. And I think that the support is actually increasing over time as you get more and more market adoption, and people can see solar on their school and their home and their business, and you know, see the electric cars are out there and working. It's the kind of thing, I think it's building momentum. And I think the right analogy is what happened with cell phones, which is, you know, a technology that, you know, didn't exist 15, 20 years ago, and now it's ubiquitous.
Okay. Well, David Hochschild, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Happy to be here. David Hochschild is the commissioner on the California Energy Commission. We'll be back after the news.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
We can feel quite small in this world and the issues so big. It's easy to forget that there are other people who need our help. What can one person do? Giving to United Way keeps great programs running in our community. Talk to your friends, your family, your co-workers. Talk about issues concerning education, income, and health. Volunteer. We can help connect you with wonderful opportunities right here that fit your skills, your passions, and your time. Contact United Way to find out what you can do. 888-3252.
If we could go back in time, we'd all change a few things. We can't time travel, but we can get tested for HIV. On average, it takes 11 years for HIV to turn into AIDS. The Centers for Disease Control recommends HIV testing for every sexually active adult. You can get tested with your doctor, or testing is free and anonymous at nearly 40 locations around Vermont. Learn more at 11years.org or call 800-882-2437.
Gunmen in Ottawa shot and wounded a Canadian soldier at the war memorial there, then entered Parliament, and shots were fired there. Arlene Tyfer is a Canadian senatorial aide. Her office is now under lockdown.
A man came running down the hallway and said, "Everybody in your offices, close the door. There's a shooter loose on the hill." And we just closed our doors and we've been sitting here.
The AP's Rita Foley reports there was a recent incident that apparently targeted Canadian soldiers.
Just days ago, two Canadian soldiers were run down by a driver in a parking lot near Montreal. One of the soldiers died. Authorities say the driver was a 25-year-old man who turned to radical Islam. Officials say he was one of 90 Islamic militant sympathizers in Canada, suspected of planning to join the fight overseas.
Witnesses say some people got out of the Parliament building by scrambling down scaffolding set up for renovations. AP Update, I'm Ed Donahue.
We are high performance, low pressure. Walker Volkswagen on the Barrie Montpelier Road is celebrating its grand reopening, and you are invited. We have finished our dealership's renovation and expansion project and are excited to share our passion for Volkswagen with you. We are so excited that we are giving away a new Volkswagen Beetle. I told you we are seriously celebrating. Take advantage of Walker Volkswagen's grand reopening celebration with our deeply discounted upfront pricing that eliminates all the gimmicks and stressful negotiations in buying your next car. When combined with 0% financing on every 2014 Volkswagen model, you can save thousands of dollars. Join in Walker Volkswagen's grand reopening celebration on the Barrie Montpelier Road. See how you can be driving an affordable German-engineered European-style Volkswagen. Stop by, call, or click walkervt.com to see why we are Vermont's source for everything Volkswagen. Oh, and remember to ask us about the Volkswagen Beetle giveaway.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're going to continue our conversation about Vermont and renewable energy. According to the Solar Foundation, Vermont ranks first in the U.S. for solar-related jobs per capita, with roughly 1,300 jobs in the state, and it's known as a leader nationally in the renewable energy field. Here to talk about how Vermont fits into the renewable revolution is Gabrielle Stebbins, Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan trade association representing nearly 300 businesses, individuals, colleges, and others committed to reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and expanding the availability of sustainable sources of power in Vermont. Gabrielle, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
So Vermont has a very ambitious goal of getting 90% of its energy needs to be coming from renewables by 2050. What's our progress?
We are doing well, but we also have more to go. And, honestly, it also depends on what we want that to look like. We've seen just in the last 2 years a doubling of solar. In the last 3 years, we've seen in Vermont three large-scale wind projects start spinning. We have seen, I believe, the announcement just in the last few months of about two $2.5 million that'll be available for schools in southern Vermont, for public schools, to be heated by modern wood heat systems. So, you know, as much as possible and in a sustainable manner, bringing as many energy options to Vermont. And obviously, of course, with the expansion of renewables, we also need to control how much energy we need. And, you know, we have a very strong Efficiency Vermont utility that provides that service. So doing really well. It's 2014. We have until 2050. So given the conversation that you just had with the California commissioner, when I think about what's going on in the military in terms of how much is being deployed and in California, yes, Vermont is leading very much for a small state. But I also think that the more that we see larger players, the military, California, Denmark, Italy, et cetera, larger players move forward, that brings all of the costs down overall. And so we'll see this point at which, you know, all of a sudden we are just going gangbusters. And that'll be very exciting to see. At this point, we're doing great, but clearly we have more to go.
What is the current proportion of our energy needs that's being met by renewables?
So the data for 2012 in terms of, you know, thermal, how we heat and cool our buildings, and in terms of transportation, that's not out yet. You can assume, you know, for transportation that a bulk of it is a very large bulk. The percent, the majority is through gasoline. And for heating our homes, the largest percentage right now is oil, followed by natural gas, and then also followed by biomass, by folks with cordwood stoves or pellet stoves, etc. The data that we have for electricity is the data that we have most recent, and that we're looking at roughly we're around 60% renewable, with a chunk of that being hydro from Canada. And the remaining portion, about 40%, is essentially what we refer to as market power. Vermont is part of our New England regional grid, and so when we are referring to market power, it's essentially purchasing power from the overall grid, which at this point is a fair amount of natural gas and a percentage of nuclear. So we're on our way, but farther to go.
So 60% of our electricity needs are currently being met by renewables, and with the biggest portion coming from hydro. How much is coming from wind and solar?
So, you know, another question, you're speaking with Renewable Energy Vermont, so we're always looking for how do we bring the jobs to Vermont on this. And the reason why I mention that is it depends on if you're talking about in-state or out-of-state. In terms of in-state, we have, I think it's roughly about 8% or so that is from biomass, from wood electricity. We have a percentage that is from New York, a very small percentage from New York hydro. The Canadian hydro is about 31% or so. From our wind projects here in Vermont, we're at about 10%. And from our in-state hydro facilities, so that all the dams that you see within Vermont, we're at about 11%. And then there are other portions for solar and for farm methane, we're at about 4%. That's what we're estimating for 2014, because the data that we really have is really from 2012.
So with all of those forms of renewable energy, hydro, wind, solar, methane, biomass, which do you foresee kind of taking the lead in terms of Vermont's renewable portfolio?
REV really advocates for a diversified portfolio. It's just as a financial advisor might tell you, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, spread your planning. That's what Renewable Energy Vermont supports as well. So we think it's smart and strategic to have, you know, a portion that's hydro, a portion that's wind, a portion that's combined heat and power, the biomass, and certainly solar, where we're seeing that grow quite a bit on people's rooftops, et cetera, and on landfills. What's really interesting to see, actually, is the Vermont legislature passed a bill a couple of years ago that requires a universal recycling to engage in the next couple of years. And so what I think will be interesting to see, we will see all those other technologies grow and expand, but I think it'll be interesting to see also what happens with food waste digesters, because we know that we're number one in the U.S. for farm methane digesters, but we have a real opportunity coming up in the next couple of years for food waste digesters. But frankly, we need to have a really diversified portfolio so that we can prepare and be prepared as the energy landscape changes over the next 5, 10, 15 years and into 2050.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation with Gabrielle Stebbins. She is the Executive Director of Renewable Energy of Vermont. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Can you explain what a digester is, how it works?
Sure. In layman's terms, it basically takes a whole bunch of materials and it has various chemicals that break down those materials. And in that breakdown process, creates electricity. So if you drive by a farm that has a farm methane digest system, you'll probably just see, you know, a large building, or not even a large, a medium-sized building that houses that system. But essentially, it's a biological process that breaks down a material, and one of the byproducts is electricity.
Okay, so back to this idea of getting to 90% in the next 35 years or so. What's the roadmap for how we get from our current 60% renewable energy portion to 90%?
So there are multiple proposals on the table right now. What I think will be interesting to see is the two primary mechanisms that we've seen help Vermont shift towards more renewables. One is our net metering program, one is what's referred to as the SPEED program. It was established in 2005. And the reason why I mention this is because both of these policies are coming up to, for lack of a better term, an expiration date in 2017. So we have a real opportunity in the next 2.5 years to redefine and refine and hone in on, you know, what have we learned over the last 15 years in terms of developing projects and building projects here and balancing our electric portfolio, and what might be the best step forward for 2017 and beyond, given our 90% by 2050 goal. In terms of roadmaps, you know, part of a roadmap is always understanding what your baseline is. There are a lot of different energy analysis tools and models being developed right now. There's one being done by University of Vermont. There are some that are being looked at by our state public service department with regards to what's called a total energy study and a total energy standard. So if we look at the thermal and the transportation as well as our power or electricity needs, how do you get, if you look at our total energy needs, how do you get to that 2050 goal? So there are a lot of analyses going on. I think some of the items that will be up on the table, I know what was discussed quite a bit at the Renewable Energy Vermont conference last week. One of the things that was discussed quite a bit was a renewable portfolio standard, essentially placing Vermont in the same same place with our neighboring states, Maine, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, et cetera, Massachusetts, so that we can enter into the same sort of renewable marketplace that they're in. So that's likely something that we'll see discussed. Certainly, it's been discussed for the last 3 years at the State House. It's definitely likely we'll see that discussed, and what that looks like and how that sets a roadmap while combining our tools to see where are we and how are we going to get to where we want to go. I think all of that's going to start to sift out in the next year and a half, 2 years.
Can you explain what a renewable portfolio standard is? I know this is the subject of a lot of debate.
Sure. It's a fancy term for you must have this much renewable by this date. So it's essentially, you know, there are different renewable portfolio standards can be designed in different ways, and they have been in the 29 or so states that have what's referred to as an RPS. The debate you're referring to is what a renewable portfolio standard has historically done is it separates out two parts of a renewable project. It separates out the energy, so the kilowatt hours or what's actually being produced, to the renewable energy credit, which is what that renewable energy attribute is. So, you know, essentially what it does is, you know, a coal plant may produce energy, but it may not have a renewable energy attribute to it. A good example, you know, McNeil Biomass System in Burlington, that's a project where it generates energy, and by improving some of its air scrubbers regarding air quality, etc., it was able to see its renewable attributes increase. So that's an example there where you see a plant or a project that is generating generating electricity, and if it makes different operating procedure improvements, etc., then it can see the renewable attributes that are associated with that plant be increased or lowered.
Now, you just mentioned about Vermont and its neighbors, and we are, of course, part of a regional electric grid. What are some of the issues being discussed in our neighboring states, and how are they going to impact us in Vermont?
So I think one of the ones we'll see come up pretty soon in November or December is a lot of discussion about electric rates increasing in some of our sister states. And the reason for that is last winter we had what everyone remembers as the polar vortex. And what that meant was a lot more demand for energy all at once. And as I mentioned earlier, Renewable Energy Vermont really supports a diversified portfolio. And in large part for this reason. What ended up happening last January and February is that essentially multiple New England states were calling upon natural gas reserves, both for electricity and for heating homes and businesses, and for you know, providing business electricity as well. What ended up happening was there was essentially not enough pipeline to deliver as much gas as was being called for right at that moment. So there are a few options there. You know, there could be a policy call to lay down more pipeline and get more gas to the end user. There could also be a policy call of no, let's continue to diversify our resources and build more solar and build more wind and you know, retrofit some of our existing hydro dams, etc., and increase efficiency and conservation. So that's one of the pieces that I think will be really interesting to watch is you know, what does it, we are part of a regional grid. What does it mean if some of our sister states are seeing these increases due to that constraint? And what is the end decision? Do we, you know, build more pipelines for natural gas to meet that constraint? Or do we move towards further diversification? I think the other one that we've seen a little bit in the news recently is, there are, as we talked about earlier, RPSs, or renewable portfolio standards, in Massachusetts and Connecticut, et cetera. And meanwhile, we're seeing some of the coal plants and the nuclear plants start to phase out. And what that leaves is some gap for how much electricity, how much power is needed. Well, if you look north of Vermont, we have hydro in Canada, of which there is some surplus. And if you look south of Vermont, we have multiple states that are really looking at an electricity gap over the next coming years. And so the question is, what is the shortest route between north of Vermont and south of Vermont? And that's through Vermont and, you know, alongside Lake Champlain. So I think the other discussion that we'll really see a lot in the next few years is, what might an electricity pipeline of hydropower from Canada look like if it comes through Vermont? What are some of the benefits to Vermont? What might Vermont look for? And in tandem of helping our sister states reach their energy needs.
Does Renewable Energy Vermont have a position on the Vermont gas pipeline that's, under construction in western Vermont?
Individual members definitely do. Renewable Energy Vermont typically focuses on really supporting and promoting renewable energy conservation efficiency. We typically don't go after the fights of other forms of energy. So, but I certainly have many members have opinions.
So one of the issues we saw arise around wind power here was the inability of the New England electric grid to receive the full output of Vermont's windmills. What's the solution to that going to be?
Sure. The immediate solution was a relatively easy one. That was a particular project, and my understanding is the owner of that project installed the technology device that was required to have ISO New England take more power from that plant. So that immediate question that came up, I think it was about a year and a half ago, has most likely since been addressed by installing the synchronous condenser on that plant. With regards to the bigger question of what does more distributed, meaning we see multiple plants and multiple projects throughout our states, what does that mean for our grid, which perhaps was historically designed to have a few large plants, like Vermont Yankee, and a few large plants in different locations? What that means is we will likely need to see more what's referred to as three-phase power, which is essentially a slightly different power line that allows for more integration of renewables into our grid. And we'll also see what I think is interesting is more of a nexus between, we know we're seeing a lot more data. Vermont was at the leading edge in terms of rolling out advanced meters, so we can start to get a much better sense of when do Vermonters and our businesses need power. At the same time, Velco last week announced a new weather forecasting initiative. What the benefit is in that, besides storm preparedness for renewables, what that means is as we become more and more technologically proficient in terms of aligning demand with when the renewable resources are available, so if you know the wind is going to blow tomorrow and you know it's going to be sunny in southern Vermont tomorrow, you know where that power will be able to be generated. And at the same time, you can combine that with looking at the customer demands through all those essentially smart meters. So I think we have a lot of change coming, but we have quite a bit of opportunity in terms of looking at the weather forecasting, aligning that with customer demand, with when the demand is, with when customers are saying, yes, we need power now, or when businesses are saying, yes, we need power now. And, you know, I know very much that Velco, our transmission provider, is actively engaged in these conversations. And what's also interesting to note is our regional grid provider, it's referred to as ISO New England. This past September, they started up what's referred to as a distributed generation working group. And basically, that is our grid operator saying, okay, what does this future look like as we see more renewables come online and as we need to start to forecast and plan for how to time these different sources with when demand is needed? So never a dull moment in the energy business.
Well, Gabrielle Stebbins, let me ask, as we're in the last few minutes here, what do you think America can learn from Vermont about renewable energy?
Yeah, it's interesting. You just heard from California, and
right.
You know, David was talking about gigawatts, and we're nowhere near gigawatts. But what I think America can learn from Vermont is that if you have a bottom-up grassroots approach where, you know, Vermonters say, yes, we want local jobs, yes, we want local resiliency and local sustainability, and you have so many town energy committees. Waterbury itself has a leading town energy committee that has done phenomenal work. When you have a bottom-up approach, and then you also have really good businesses within the state and customers that want to go renewable in the middle, and then you have you know, an administration that is supporting renewables from sort of the top down as well as the bottom up, that you can do quite a bit. And I think what's great about Vermont is we're small and we're nimble, and frankly, we know everyone. You know, with a population of 630,000, we know everybody, and we can get so much done much more quickly and efficiently than perhaps some of the other larger states. And once we've rolled out various policy mechanisms, various financial opportunities, and solved some of the technical issues that may arise, all of that is replicable in other states.
Now, last week, as you mentioned, you just had your annual conference, Renewable Energy Conference. What was one thing that you picked up there that you just think is incredibly cool or interesting?
I think the shifting in terms of our overall electric grid is really interesting. We know utilities have a critical role to play. You know, they manage our infrastructure as well as Velco. And yet it's a real new paradigm to have, you know, individual customers, individual Vermonters be able to be little mini generators. So I think one of the interesting conversations is what does that future look like? And then I'll also just say, you know, I think the conference closed out with a really interesting conversation about how we can align all of our little net metered solar systems, et cetera, with when we need energy the most. And there's some really great opportunities there in terms of looking at the data, looking at the technology, developing the public will, supporting our politicians to move forward on these policies. And all of that combined, I think, is a very hopeful beacon for the future.
Okay. Well, Gabrielle Stebbins, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much, David.
Gabrielle Stebbins is the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all past shows of the Vermont Conversation at vermontconversation.com. I'm David Goodman, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and their some 750 members, along with additional support from National Life Insurance for over 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, Fairpoint. Small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By The Alchemist, serving Greater Waterbury since 2003. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And Green Mountain Power, all partnering with customers to promote clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. Join us next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Vermont Conversations with David Goodman.
And coming up, we'll have a world and national news update at 2 o'clock. Music with the Getaway, a full 2 hours, and a chance to win some tickets to Rodrigo and Gabrielle coming into the Flynn Theater on Monday night. All part of the Getaway on locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier.
Police in the Canadian capital, Ottawa, say a soldier and one suspected gunman...